Hello and welcome to the Will to Power Hour, your friendly neighborhood philosophy podcast. Coming to you from the Mulcair National Wildlife Refuge outside of Burns, Oregon, I am Yosef Schiff.
This is Joshu Tsushima.
I'm Alex Holt.
And I'm Sarah Shabby.
If you are unfamiliar with how our podcast works, we spend the first few minutes of each episode reviewing a different craft beer. We then spend the remainder drinking said beer whilst we wax philosophical. Each episode revolves around a particular question or text, and today's topic is...
Zombies!
Thank you, Alex. Zombies.
Yes.
Well, topic is really morality, but it's in the context of zombie killing. We'll begin our discussion with an overview of Immanuel Kant's Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals, followed by a discussion of utilitarianism. But there's a twist. We're going to apply each of these two ethical theories to the question of when it's okay to kill a zombie. We're going to present several examples of situations you just might find yourself in come the zombie apocalypse. The examples are arranged by increasing levels of danger, and we'll present the first example, and we're going to use that example to lay out generally what each of those two theoretical approaches to morality is, and then we're just going to move on to the other examples in turn. So the other examples are going to go much more quickly. But before we give our first example, we need to talk about our beer. Today, we're drinking Ballast Point Grapefruit Sculpin IPA. It's a grapefruit-flavored India Pale Ale. It's about 7% ABV. Let's, I guess, pop these bad boys open. Cheers. Should we cheers?
Cheers.
L'chaim to podcasting. First, I guess, examination of the color. It's very clear. A nice kind of orangish color. Kind of an amber color. Anything notable? No, that's pretty
good.
Nothing too notable about the appearance of it. I think it's definitely very good. This is an IPA. It's very grapefruity, as the name Grapefruit IPA might suggest. I don't know. I think what I like about, a lot of IPAs are citrusy, and this one's pretty citrusy, but grapefruits are really kind of bitter, so it, enhances the bitterness. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I like it.
I like it.
It's not too crazy. You know, bitter, but it's enough that it feels good. Deal with it.
So yeah, I mean it's a good beer. I can definitely see myself getting drunk off it. It's probably much more summery. I mean, it's not really a wintry. But it is very good. I guess moving on from the beer. So before we give our first example situation you might find yourself in, we need to clarify something. We need to talk about the different types of zombies and why we're only going to focus in on them. So I'll let Alex explain the history of zombies and what we're going to be looking at.
So if you look through the history of cinema, there are several different types of zombies that appear. The first is from the 1932 film White Zombie. That was starring Bela Lugosi. And he was starring in this sort of racist movie as a Haitian sorcerer, some sort of evil guy whose name was literally Murder. And yeah, no, it was really bad. So this evil guy that Bela Lugosi plays takes people and uses a potion to turn them into zombies. And what happens is they appear to die, but actually just go into a deep sleep, and then awake as sort of automatons that he can instruct and have, do his bidding. And so what he generally does with these zombies is he uses them to run factories and, just sort of do menial labor. And during the course of the film, some Americans traveling there get caught up in this web of deceit and, evil, and he turns one of them into a zombie. And eventually, a bunch of shit goes down, he dies, all that, crazy stuff happens, but that's the basic idea of how zombies are created. He administers this potion, and then they wake up as his, as automatons to do his bidding. And so they don't actually die, although they do appear to at one point. Now, the next major zombie film that I'm reviewing would be Night of the Living Dead. And that was 1968. So Night of the Living Dead had people who died were reanimated by, as a result of some astrological phenomenon, radiation coming down to Earth, causing them to reanimate after they were dead.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Pretty much, yeah. And so it turned them into this sort of mindless killers that would wander around and just eat people. They were already dead. There was only this, reanimated, biological material left. And they would go around eating people. And so that was the type of zombie that dominated for many years until, let's see, I want to say the first viral zombie appeared in 28 Days Later, although it could have been earlier. That was the first major viral zombie movie. And in that one, we had zombies where it wasn't that people died and were reanimated. Instead, what happened was a virus spread by bodily fluids, blood, saliva, would be spread from person to person and cause the victim to lose the capacity for sophisticated rational thought and become this, instinctual killers that would run around eating people. And I believe 28 Days Later was the first time zombies were really fast, which, makes it a scary on a whole level.
Yeah, they were absolutely terrifying to have this thing come at you.
Oh, yeah. They were super fast and really scary and just enraged all the time.
Did the virus make them faster, or did it just make them angry?
No, it just turned them
faster. It was the first time they could actually run.
Yeah, it was the first time they could actually run.
Yeah, and most of the time they're just kind of like walking around. You can kind of escape them. If you get them, you're stupid, but...
Yeah, before then it was always shuffling and shambling and whereas in 28 Days Later it was they're running as fast as you are and they're going to eat you and tear you apart. So it was a very different type of zombie, and it's much more interesting philosophically speaking for our purposes talking about viral zombies, because they're still alive and they're running around killing people, which is the magic combination, The ones from White Zombie were still alive, but they weren't really doing anything terribly interesting. They were just kind of, doing menial labor, doing factory jobs, which, given the fact that a lot of people are, forced to do that kind of job anyway, makes you wonder, are you really any better off than the zombie?
Aren't we all?
God, I hope not. Anyway, but that one had zombies that were still alive, but it didn't have them doing anything particularly sinister. But now, and then Night of the Living Dead had them doing something very sinister, but they were already dead, so it didn't really care about killing them.
So whatever ethical implications there might be seem to be at the most, they just seem to be minimal.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't
because they're dead.
So. I mean, they're already dead. What can you do to them, really? Right. I mean, come on.
So it's the viral zombie that's more interesting because people, they're not.
They never die.
Right, they didn't die.
And to be clear, they don't have a terminal illness. They have an incurable illness.
They have an incurable illness.
And I think...
Well, incurable so far. I mean, it's not inconceivable that they could be cured. But
the distinction I'm drawing here is that they're not terminally ill. So
yeah, they don't die from the illness.
Right,
so
when you think of most zombie films...
They're already dead.
They're either... When you think of most zombie films, or even, something like The Walking Dead, someone gets bitten, and they eventually will turn into a zombie. So they're more like terminally ill, so to speak.
But wouldn't you say that part of them is dying, though? Like, they
turn into zombies, but they don't...
Yeah.
They die. No,
part of their soul or whatever makes them a person would die.
Well, but at least in The Walking Dead, you get bitten, you die, and then you become a zombie. And there's this period of time that's kind of indeterminate, differs in every individual situation
between when
you die and when you reanimate. And so you're in The Walking Dead, at least you're dead as a doornail, and you come back as a zombie. But once you're bitten, that's you basically. I think you get like a fever and like all this stuff. So it's basically kind of analogous to a terminally ill patient. But the viral zombies, they're not viral zombies. The viral zombies, and again, they're the most interesting, I think, for our purposes, as Alex pointed out, because they're still alive and they don't die. I mean, they'll eventually die just like everyone else, but there's nothing special about their process of death.
So, with viral zombies, they're still alive. It's conceivable that they could be cured and brought back to, you know, normal humans. But currently, they pose an immense danger because they're attacking and murdering and, you know, eating people alive.
And they're contagious.
And they're contagious, yes. Highly contagious. And, all right, so that's viral zombies. That's the one we're going to be discussing, and I want to point out, we will not be discussing philosophical zombies.
What's a philosophical zombie?
Really stupid thought experiment.
What, so zombies philosophizing on...
No. It's not quite. No. A philosophical zombie is someone who... Let's see. They behave exactly as a human being would, but they have no internal experience. So it's essentially as if...
You mean, okay.
So it's essentially as if your coworker is just, you know, acting exactly like all your other coworkers are, except they have no thoughts. They have no conscious experience. They're just
maybe like a drug addict, like someone who's going through the world, like not really experiencing.
Way worse than that. Like to the
worse point, than that.
Literally, no. There's no self. There's you can almost think about like a person walking around, kind of like as a human marionette. In a certain way. It's someone without any kind of thought, any kind of inner experience, nothing. But they look and act just like a human, or like, you know, a robot that was remarkably human-like that had no consciousness for walking around. It's a thought experiment. We just wanted to point out that we're not going to be talking.
Okay.
So, behaviorally indistinguishable from people, but they have no soul.
But again, aren't we all really just zombies?
I'm trying to navigate this world.
All right, so now that we got that out of the way, and before we actually go into the first example, Sarah, we brought you to this program because a question came up. Well, we brought you on for two reasons. One, a question came up in our pilot episode on modal realism as to whether or not zombies can have orgasms. So, I guess I think we refer to them as zorgasms.
Yes.
Zorgasms, okay.
So, first of all, tell us a little about yourself. You are kind of uniquely qualified, I think, to speak to both zombie orgasms and to the broader question of zombies and ethics. So tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you're from, and more importantly, what you do.
Well, I am a third-year PhD student at a school in California, in San Francisco. And I'm studying clinical psychology. I want to work with people with basically traumatic brain injuries or acquired brain injuries and do sort of neurorehabilitation. And I'm currently working in a neurorehabilitation facility. So I get to kind of do that firsthand and see what it's like. Pretty cool. But I'm originally from Ohio. So I don't know. Does that make me uniquely qualified? I guess maybe.
Well, it's the neurology, you know, the neuroscience part that I think makes you uniquely qualified to speak about zombies, because, I mean, a lot of this has to do with what's, you know, going on in a zombie brain. So I guess the first question is, zombies have orgasms. You know, how do orgasms work, and whether zombies can have them, and do we need to distinguish, I guess, between the types of zombies?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so, because, like, the first thing I thought of when you asked me this question several months ago was, what kind of zombies are we talking about? Are we talking about the kind that can deteriorate, like, maybe their death, like, if parts of their, you know, you've seen movies where, like, parts of their brain are missing or something like that, or they're walking around with, like, a half of a skull and stuff. So if that's the case, then that might change it. So that, I mean, does that qualify for the type that we're talking about today?
Probably not, but I'm wondering, can zombies like that have orgasms? Would it just be like dust?
Because there are several different parts of your brain that are activated during an orgasm. And so that's why I was curious as to whether or not that was the kind of, because if there was deterioration of the brain tissue, then that's a different story. And whether or not the kind that died first and came back, whether, you know, obviously there'd be brain death in that as well. So then the functioning of the brain might change. So that's why I had to, like, clarify. I guess I could start off with just an explanation of how it works, and then maybe you guys can figure it out on your, you know. That would help? Yeah. Okay. So, like, initially when a person is having, and now this is what I've been able to find. Some of this is my own knowledge and some of this is from an article, but it's from women. So, I mean, I think it's basically the same except for the sexual organs that are activated, but I think the areas in the brain are the same. When you first start off, you know, touching or kissing, the area of your brain that's activated is the sensory cortex, which is in the parietal lobe, which is not the frontal, you know, it's kind of like the back part of your brain, but not all the way in the back where your base of your skull is. Well, different sexual organs or different areas of your body are activated on different parts of that. So it's like different parts of that whole sensory cortex is activated. And that's where it starts off.
Okay.
And so if there was an injury to that part of the brain, like, or if it was deteriorating, then you might not be able to start. I mean, you might, but.
Presumably, you would still have some sensory ability intact.
So yeah, because
that
right.
Zombies have an intact sensory cortex that's still functioning.
I mean, they do seem to react when they get hit. So, I mean, I would imagine that it's just not as impactful as it would be for us, per se. And so, like, the second part of it is when you're kind of, like, continued stimulation, it activates the hippocampus, which is kind of deeper within the brain. You said you guys kind of know what I'm talking about, right? So I don't have to go into detail.
Sure.
The rhino campus.
Yeah, the rhino campus. Yeah, that's basically a big part of your memory and, like, short-term memory, but it also evokes the dreamlike memories. So you get kind of in, like, a dreamlike state, you're starting to feel good. And then you have the amygdala, which is the part for emotional expression, which is kind of what's seen the most, like, for instance, if you have a frontal lobe brain injury, it's like your instincts. So if some guy hits on your woman, you want to punch him in the face, that's your amygdala. So it's in, like, kind of those intense feelings. And that's in the middle of...
So if Wayne Brady needs to choke a bitch, that's probably the part of your brain that's telling you that Wayne Brady needs to choke a bitch.
Yes. And that's like if you're in the car and some guy cuts you off and you want to go follow him for 20 minutes and then hit him. I mean, not that that's happened to me, but I'm just saying.
Right.
So that's that part. But then your frontal lobe is the one that tells you, no, dude, it's not worth it. But this part sort of is kind of shut off during, I would say, sex. Okay. It's not shut off per se, but I would say it's less important. So you don't want to be thinking during sex. You want to be just enjoying it.
Right.
So I guess don't have the sort of sophisticated reasoning ability we have. So what parts of the brain would have to be deteriorating or ineffective for that to be the case? I assume
which part?
It would still be more or less intact.
I would say that would be the frontal lobe.
For the rational to cease.
Yeah, so like I was saying, is usually during sex, the frontal lobe will probably just stop being important. But that's the kind of thing that rationalizes, like, hey, don't beat up that dude. That's the part that's telling you to kind of calm it down, and it actually has a lot of thought processes, and it, you know, it thinks before on what can happen and stuff like that. So that the frontal lobe would be the thing that had to be shut down in order for, or not shut down, but impaired in order for you to to just act on instinct rather than emotion.
So it seems like with viral zombies, there shouldn't be anything inhibiting them from having orgasms, assuming that the virus isn't attacking that part of the brain. Like with Night of the Living Dead zombies or Walking Dead zombies,
they're definitely out.
They're decaying. They're slowly decaying.
See, that's the other part of it that I was wondering too, because there are neurotransmitters that are activated during sex as well. And so if they have the parts, but their body's not actually working, then I don't know if they'd actually have the reaction that we would have, because there's a lot of oxytocin involved. You know, you have an increase in dopamine. And if that doesn't happen, you might not feel the same enjoyment. You might be able to do the action, but it might not be as rewarding.
But it seems like in my mind, it's almost as if the Walking Dead zombies or the Night of the Living Dead zombies, they're going to have a kind of slowly degrading ability to have one. Is what it seems like, right? Because
I would imagine. And that's why they're always seen depicting going after people rather than going to fuck people, because that's not really their main, I would say that's not their main motivation. And it depends on like what their needs and drives are striving for. So if they need food or something like that, they'd go for that first.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of, you know, the hierarchy of needs.
Yeah. And if they do have an orgasm, it's just kind of meh. It's not that great.
It's like, wow, I'd rather have food.
Right.
Somebody's brains. Yeah.
Exactly. Like
you got the crowd of zombies, and like all of them are just super, you know, they're just super hungry, going out, like just devouring flesh. But then there's that one zombie who's just like no, I'm just really horny, guys. I gotta go do this. I think
to in the interests of time, I think we should move on to the.
By the way, Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies.
It's coming out in, it's going to be released in theaters. I don't know when, but it's soon. People will definitely have to see. All right, so that was the first reason we brought you on, was to talk about zombie orgasms.
Right.
Reason was, before getting into a philosophical discussion about different theories of morality, I was hoping you could give us some insight into clinical ethics. So Joshua, Alex, and I, we're lawyers, and right. we're governed by the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct. Those tell us ethically how we need to act. And you know, doctors are governed by a set of ethics. I don't know if, you know, that your set of, if whatever document that governs the ethics of your profession is the same as doctors or what, but I was wondering what it says about things like pulling the plug on a patient or assisted suicide, and especially in light of the fact that your own state, California, I think about a month or two ago, passed a law allowing doctors to prescribe lethal medication to terminally ill patients. Because, you know, there's a lot of talk in zombie films, and zombie literature about killing them. So it brings into question this idea of ethics and things like assisted suicide. I was just wondering if you had any insight into that issue.
Well, see, I have to clarify first off by saying psychologists, we're not allowed to like prescribe medication, and we're not allowed to like give medication as far as that. I mean, there are a few states that allow us to, and California is not one of them yet.
So you can't kill people.
Huh? So I can't kill people legally yet. No, well, unfortunately.
Yeah. You can kill people with your brain, other than that.
Just with my mind. That's it. Yes. So the other thing is because it's such a new thing, first off, psychology is one of those things that it's like we have a lot of fuzzy gray areas right now. As far as electronic correspondence for psychologists, can you have something as far as a Facebook? Can you be so involved in social media? Can you do things like have sessions over the phone without having to meet in person? And what's the privacy laws and all that stuff? And there's a lot of gray areas that they haven't even made laws for yet. And they usually leave it into the judgment of the psychologist. And then in the end, the psychologist can get sued. And so it's so much fun. But as far as...
Leave it up to the psychologist. Just, you know.
Yeah. Just let them take the heat. So as far as physician-assisted suicide, I think we would have to be of the approach where we couldn't say anything on the record as far as, yes, we endorse it, or yes or no, we don't. Because I feel like we always come from the point of the patients. I've had several clients tell me that they wanted to die, and, you know, they're dying anyways, and they feel this certain way, and I feel conflicted because they don't have their own rights. So it's like they're legally required to stay alive until, you know, whatever, until they die, and it just doesn't seem right. But as far as if a client were to come to me and disclose that they wanted to do this and they were thinking about doing this, I mean, technically I should tell someone that they're suicidal. And then they would be hospitalized for 3 days. But then I would have to weigh it with my own self. What would be in the best interest of my client? So I think if they were going to die, you know, I would support them without having an official supporting stance. But I would do it in session and, you know, try and do as much ethical red tape, or try and get around the ethical red tape as much as possible.
Okay.
Do
psychologists also take the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take?
No, because they don't
prescribe. No.
They don't? Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there some sort of oath that you take?
No. We have like an ethical code that we have to abide by, but it's different. They have the APA, which is the American Psychological Association, and that's usually what most states abide their rules by. Or like it's not technically a legal body, but most of the states in America have designed their laws to be by them. And so that's kind of who we have to listen to. But as of now, there's nothing really to kind of say yes or no. And it's kind of annoying. Like we have like 5 codes or oaths that we have to say that we'll follow. And that's just in the best interest of our client and stuff like that. But that specific issue hasn't been touched.
So you're saying you don't know if you're allowed to kill a zombie?
No. I mean, I personally wouldn't do it, but I'd support someone if they wanted to. Does that make sense?
If they were and wanted to die, if they were going to become a zombie and they wanted to die, you would support them?
on a
more- I would say I like I couldn't come out and officially write in my notes that I would support them, and I can't come out and say that, but if we were in session and they were disclosing this to me, I'd have first the first thing I'd have to do is check to make sure that like they're, you know, what you would say like a mental status.
Yes.
See if they're, you know, technically inclined and they're actually able to make that decision. And so right. if they pass that, then I mean that's not that's I, this is my position at least. that's up to them if they want to do the rest. I just would have to kind of keep it out of my notes that okay. I know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, and as far as the other question, sorry, the other type of zombie that they're not technically dead or not dying, but they're on.
Yeah.
So that thing is interesting to me only because I work at a locked mental institution. So like to
a lot of dangerous people.
Yeah. So to me, it kind of reminds me of that. Like it would almost be like you would lock them up until they're ready, till they find the cure.
Are you broadcasting from the institution?
I'm sorry.
Are you broadcasting from the institution?
Yes, I am at a sane asylum right now. And where did you say we were? Oregon?
Yeah, the Mulher National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, we have one of those locked mental institutions there, so that's where I'm coming from. I
mean, it's pretty much actually a mental institution.
We'll see. That's what I'm saying. But it's just interesting. I think had I not worked there, I probably would have been like, no, keep them forever and they can do whatever they want. But now I'm like, maybe we should lock them up and keep them somewhere safe. I don't know if I'd be on the board unless they wanted to.
Wait, sorry, are we talking about zombies or Oregon militiamen?
We are talking about zombies, okay. But
are Oregon militiamen a comparable?
But thank you for clarifying.
Like the next great medical journal article.
Okay, well, do you have anything else for us? Is that about it?
If you have any more questions for me, I might be able to answer them. I don't. That was what I had prepared.
Two issues. It was, you know, zombie orgasms, because we thought they were funny and interesting. And then also just kind of the more relevant question of how clinical ethics works. And,
okay.
Cool. All right, well, we appreciate you joining us.
Hey, no thing.
Answering our incredibly important relevant questions.
Very relevant to society, I understand. Yeah. All right, guys, you have fun.
Yeah, thanks. We'll talk to you later.
All right, take care.
Thanks. See ya. Bye. So, Alex.
Yes.
First example of a situation that I just might find myself in come the impending zombie apocalypse.
All right.
And again, we're going to... This example is going to take a little bit of time because we're going to use it to actually sketch out the general aspects of both the two main approaches to ethics. And then the other examples will be much quicker. So, Alex,
all right, first example. So, first example is you see a zombie far off across a river or a canyon that it can't cross. You have a rifle and you could easily kill this zombie with a single shot from this distance. But the zombie would not pose a threat to you for the foreseeable future.
Okay, so you see a zombie, we know they're dangerous, but they're not...
But not dangerous to you, because, you know, you're far away.
Or really anybody else.
It's at least not now.
It's up in the air whether or not. So the first major approach to ethics that we're going to talk about is Immanuel Kant's theory of morality, which is also known as the categorical imperative. So just a little bit of a very short background on Kant. He was born April 22nd, 1724, died February 12th, 1804, at the age of 79. He was a German philosopher and really is the giant of Western philosophy. He is probably the single most important figure in Western philosophy. His importance is really hard to overstate his importance. Nearly everything that we're going to ever talk about on this podcast was either invented by Kant or was at least touched upon by Kant. He truly is an important figure, and any undergraduate philosophy student or graduate philosophy student is going to encounter Kant at some point. He was raised in a strict pietist home, although he became skeptical of religion later in life. He was extremely disciplined and kind of had a bit of an odd personality. He was apparently obsessively punctual and routine oriented. He was known for going on
his morning walks, for instance, at precisely the same time every day, and it was said that his neighbors would set their clocks by his morning walks. But what's actually even more interesting was the fact that he took the same number of steps every single time he went out for a morning walk.
Wait, so what would happen if he missed a step?
You know, I don't know. I don't know.
Like, what if there was somebody in the way, he had to walk around them and would have five steps? And
I don't know, but that would be a really awkward situation. Took longer steps the rest of the way. Ooh, yeah.
Much longer steps. What
if it was like right when he got to his house?
He'd wait until they moved out of the way. You'd have to just wait there.
Just stare him down.
Yeah.
So he has OCD is pretty much what you're saying.
Well, that's what it sounds like, or something similar. I mean, when you take the same number of steps every time you take a morning walk and you do it at the same time, I mean, it sounds like you got something. That you're doing. So that was just kind of an odd, you know, personality quirk. And, you know, he also suffered lifelong headaches, probably migraines, and ended up developing dementia later in life. And actually, those two traits are, you know, much like Nietzsche, but...
I think so defining characteristic of philosophers is OCD and
well maybe but Nietzsche's dementia also happened to come from syphilis that he contracted at a brothel. So I don't want to assume that Kant just went to a brothel. I don't know Kant.
Yeah, he probably wasn't.
I'm sure he was a good guy. I don't know.
He was
know.
A little maybe too repressive to do that, I think.
Well, but those are the kind of people that lash out, and right?
That's true. Like, you know, he might have gone to a brothel
in a rebellious stage of his life, you know?
Against the repression syphilis. That otherwise defined him.
It was just a middle finger to his father, you know? I don't know. I don't know what his motivation
Let's not speculate.
Yeah.
Too much.
Yeah. Be a little unfair to Kant. So, one of his most famous works was...
I mean, the guy thought masturbation was worse than suicide. You really think he's going to end up in a brothel?
He did think masturbation was pretty bad.
No, he literally said that wanton self-abuse, otherwise, a.k.a. masturbation, is therefore worse than self-murder. Like, that's like a quote from one of his writings. Like, little bit weird, but, you know, I don't think he's the kind of guy who's going to a problem.
Maybe instead of talking about zombie orgasm, we should have talked about con orgasm.
Well, I don't think we have much to talk about. There probably wasn't a whole lot of that going on.
What you're saying is that we can't talk about much.
Oh, my God. Yossi, just stop.
So, Kant. One of his most famous works... is called The Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals, or A Framework for the Metaphysics of Morals, or The Grounding for the Metaphysics of Morals. It depends on your translation, because again, who's a German philosopher?
Metaphysics of Morals. We'll just call it that.
No, we will not call it that, because that was a later book.
Whatever.
He wrote another book later called The Metaphysics of Morals
that gave content to
the theory that he developed in The Groundwork.
Is that a pun too? Content.
Shut up, Joshua. So, Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals, it was published in 1785, again, one of his most famous works, and it's really a staple of ethics courses, and every single philosophy undergrad or graduate student has read it, and loved it, and hated it, all in equal measure. And this is what Kant used to lay out his theory of morality. And what he did was, he started with our common moral feelings, our kind of common sense intuitions about how morality works. And he wanted to work backwards from that to try and figure out the underlying moral principles that we all have. He wanted to discover the supreme principles of morality. And more importantly, he wanted to ground morality. He wanted to make normative statements, statements about obligations, statements about what we ought to do. He wanted to make those statements necessary, and he wanted to give them force. He wanted to make them necessary in the same way that the logical statement 2 + 2 = 4 is necessary. And this led him to develop his theory of morality, the supreme moral principle that he called the categorical imperative. And through his line of reasoning, he came to the conclusion that moral laws need to have the form of a categorical imperative. When we say categorical imperative, what we mean is, you know, an imperative is something that you have to do. And if it's categorical, it means you have to do it in all circumstances. It's unconditional. Okay, so it's basically, he was saying that our moral principles have to have the form of laws that you have to follow in every circumstance. And this sort of makes sense, right?
when we evaluate people's morality, when we evaluate a person morally, we tend to separate their intent from their actions. So like if I'm walking down the street and I see someone being mugged and I attack the attacker, let the victim get away, but then it turns out that the attacker is actually a police officer and the victim was a violent criminal. Assuming that you were acting reasonably, your actions would still be praiseworthy. They would be commendable, right? I mean, we would say that you're a good person, even though it led to these bad consequences because you really ended up attacking a police officer. You didn't know it was a police officer. You had a good heart. You were just trying to do the right thing. So we tend to separate intent from actions, and we say, like, you were following a moral rule, you know, that it's not okay to attack people unjustifiably. It's not okay to steal someone's purse or someone's wallet. So this sort of makes sense that morality comes from laws, and that acting morally is following those rules simply out of respect for those rules. So it's a deontological approach. A deontological approach to morality is a rule-based approach. You examine the morality of an action based on whether or not the person acting, the agent, was acting in accordance with moral rules rather than the consequences of their actions. So Kant took this approach, and he said that the supreme principle of morality is going to have that form. It's going to have that form of a categorical imperative. It's going to be a law. And he came up with three different formulations that are all kind of dependent on each other. They're all equal formulations. And I think that the first two are really the most interesting in talking about zombies. The third formulation isn't quite as interesting. We'll still mention it. But what we'll do is we'll just talk about the two first formulations real quick. And then, I don't know, should we talk about the example then or talk about utilitarianism?
Then utilitarianism.
Okay.
Then the example.
And then we'll talk about utilitarianism briefly. The utilitarianism is a little bit easier to grasp than Kant's categorical imperative. And then we'll talk about the first example. So the first formulation of the categorical imperative is the so-called universalization formula. So it says, act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it become a universal law. When he says maxim, he means a rule or a statement. So act only on that rule through which at the same time you would will that it become a universal law, or that everybody else, every other rational creature, would be acting on the same rule. Okay, so how does this work in practice? So in other words, when you consider a course of action, for example, whether you're going to lie to someone in order to get money. So say that you need some money. You promise a friend that if they give you the money, you'll pay them back. But you don't really intend to keep the promise because you can't or you won't, but you make the promise anyway. So in considering whether to actually make that promise, you would reformulate your course of action as a prescription for everyone to follow, and then consider what that world would look like. So the maxim would be something like, if you need ready cash, make a lying promise to someone. Promise them you'll pay them back even though you won't. And then consider what that world would look like if everyone acted that way. So conceive of a world where it's okay for everyone to do that. Well, Kant says that when you conceive of such a world, you actually run into a logical contradiction. Because if everyone is lying, if everyone is making a promise that they don't keep, the entire institution of promise making ceases to make sense. Because there wouldn't even really be any such thing as a promise if promises were nothing, essentially.
Well,
I mean,
here's my issue. I mean, okay, that would be true. We couldn't make promises that were dependable if relying on the literal promises themselves. But is it conceivable to have a society that functions where knowingly everybody is lying to each other?
Well, yeah, but then
right,
promises,
but then the promises
wouldn't
carry any weight.
They wouldn't be the same thing that promises.
So what?
But
no, that's the thing.
That's the point, though.
The
what
point
he's
is
saying,
that you know, if you make a promise in this world, in this society,
mm-hmm.
it carries certain weight. It gets you something.
So
it carries a certain
kind of
that society
promises
won't
have
get
value.
You. Yes.
Okay. Well, assuming that the word promise even means anything. Not just that it has value, but that it means anything. He's saying that in a world in which everyone does this,
mm-hmm.
in which everyone breaks their promises literally any time that it suits their needs, the entire institution of promise making doesn't actually make sense. It's not conceivable. That there
because
would actually
just,
because there wouldn't be any such thing as a promise because
a promise is when you're going to do something
my
no matter what
is that a bad thing?
That's not the question.
That's irrelevant to this.
It's completely irrelevant.
But that's his point, though, is that...
No. That's not his point. His point is that promise-making would cease to become a thing.
So why is that a problem?
And that's what we're getting to. So he's basically saying you reformulate this course of action. He's saying that if you can't conceive of that world, if there's a logical problem, then that course of action is immoral. And this is like put your entire glasses frame in your mouth.
Good. Fog it up so I can clean it.
So it's kind of like a do unto others type idea, not quite the same thing, but kind of similar. So all what he's saying, it's basically a non-contradiction test of morality. And what he's really claiming is that every rational creature, he doesn't limit his discussion just to humans, to people. He's saying that any rational creature will come to this conclusion that you need to follow these moral laws. He's saying that you cannot conceive of a world in which people make lying promises because that whole institution would just fall apart. It wouldn't make sense. That's what he's identifying morality with. He's just, again, starting with our common sense feelings and working backwards. And he says that this is what we end up working backwards to. The second formulation of the categorical imperative says, act so that you use humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, always at the same time as an end, never merely as a means. So never use other people as means, use them as ends. Never use them as a means to your own end. Always respect them, respect their humanity. And I think, importantly, when he says humanity, what he seems to mean is rationality. Because he spends his entire discussion of morality basically saying that any rational being is going to come to the same conclusions. An alien race that's rational, human beings that are rational, any rational being. So it's not just limited to people. So when he says humanity, what he seems to really mean is rational beings. And he gets to the second formulation through this analysis of, it's this kind of analysis of why we find certain things like, for instance, art, for example, valuable. Ultimately, things like art are valuable simply because, for whatever reason, we value them. We find them important. So it seems that we're the thing that we're basing all other value on. So we, as people, as rational beings, are ends in ourselves. So you should never treat another person as anything other than an end in themselves. People are unconditionally valuable. That's kind of what he's saying. And really briefly, the third formulation of the categorical imperative is something like we should act that we may think of ourselves as legislating universal laws through our maxims. When we follow this principle, we conceive of ourselves as legislative citizens in the kingdom of ends. It's the so-called kingdom of ends formulation. When he talks about legislating, that legislating part gets at his notion of autonomy and free will, which is kind of going to lead us down a rabbit hole, and it's not really relevant to our discussion, so we'll probably save that for a future discussion. But so that the first formulation, the universalization formulation, the second formulation, the humanity formulation. I think the second formulation is more relevant to our discussion because there's a question of whether zombies should be included under this rubric of humanity. I think Alex thinks that the first formulation is more relevant. Why do you think the first formulation is more relevant?
Well, I think the subject of their humanity is not as undecided as you seem to indicate. So you want me to explain that in detail?
I don't know. Do you want to do utilitarianism first? Do you want to do the example?
Yeah, we can do utilitarianism first. All right. So utilitarianism is the theory that what is moral, what is right, is whatever will increase utility. And by increasing utility, they don't mean that, you know, you're just going to get lucky and happen to increase whatever you view as utility. It's whatever course of action will increase the likelihood and the expected total value of utility in the world, whatever, you know, you define as utility is. So, for instance, classical utilitarianism defines utility as happiness. Other forms allow for different levels of happiness, different types, some more important than others, but the basic idea is that whatever will increase the total amount of happiness in the world, that's what you should be increasing by your actions, and that your actions are evaluated
based on whether they increase happiness or not.
And the different utilitarians over time have had different views of what happiness is, right?
That's true. So, some said it was just pure physical pleasure. Some it was more higher levels of happiness associated with, for instance, art or music or, you know, complex, you know, thought.
And that was the Millian view, right? The higher versus lower pleasures.
It's just mill, yeah.
So basically, you know, just real briefly going back to Bentham, who was the original exponent of utilitarianism, he kind of took the view of hedonism, you know, just purely pain and pleasure. Mill, who came a little bit later, wrote this treatise called Utilitarianism. It was an essay kind of defending utilitarianism against its naysayers and against against the common criticisms of utilitarianism. And one of the criticisms was, oh, you guys just mean hedonism. And Mill said, no, we need to separate things like the lower pleasures from the higher pleasures. The lower pleasures being things like physical pleasure and pain versus these higher level pleasures like art, you know, and intellectual exploration.
Yeah.
And he kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, someone who had, he basically said that when we talk about utilitarianism, it's maximizing higher pleasures that matters. And the reason he said maximizing higher pleasures matters is that if you take a person who's capable of experiencing both the highest and the lowest pleasures, they're going to say the higher pleasures are better. They have a better quality. So, you know, within utilitarianism, there's a difference in what we even mean by happiness and pleasure.
Sure.
Want to move on to maybe, like, who's good we're trying to maximize? Like, what do we even mean by maximizing?
So, I'm not sure where each philosopher fell on this particular issue.
Bentham, greatest happiness.
Okay, Bentham said greatest happiness for greatest number of people, whereas Singer says it's an equal consideration of interests. For our purposes, those should be about the same when considering zombies, frankly. But yeah, there's,
I don't know. I mean, with Singer, though, like it part of it depended on like an individual's capacity for suffering. I guess we have to figure out whether zombies can suffer and whether they're even worthy of our interest, right?
They can suffer. Well, viral zombies. So,
oh, do they not? Wait, okay, so,
I mean, they don't have the capacity for, like, complex rational thought, but they still have the capacity for pleasure, pain, you know, that sort of stuff.
What if I, like, walk up to a viral zombie, punch him in the face? Is he going to feel that?
Yeah, he might, yeah.
He might. Should we assume that he does or not?
I think so. I mean, they can sense, their sensory capabilities are still intact, more or less. I mean, they can see people from far off. They can smell and hear people. I mean, there's no reason to think that their sense of touch or their nociception is compromised.
Okay, so they
can feel pain.
Okay, so they're deserving of our equal consideration.
Well, I didn't say that. I'm just saying they can feel pain. So, you know, if you can avoid punching them in the face, all the better.
Okay.
At least according to utilitarianism.
Are we assuming they're even conscious of any of their experiences and their zombie state?
Well, I guess because they're viral zombies.
They are capable of...
What are viral... I mean...
It depends on what you mean by consciousness.
So,
they're capable... I mean, they can feel pleasure and pain, certainly. But I guess...
Do they have the same conscious state as they would if they were not infected? The only difference being that they have these new impulses to devour other people and spread them.
Can a viral zombie even be happy? That's one thing I'm wondering.
Well, I think their amygdala might be intact, so they might be able to experience some sort of happiness. It's just they lack the sort of reasoning ability that typifies human beings.
I think this kind of matters. So are they capable of higher pleasure?
No. Higher pleasures?
They probably aren't.
No, not higher pleasures, but regular pleasure, like, you know, base order, you know, I eat a donut and feel happy because it's sweet. They don't know that. No, but they eat flesh. It tastes just as good.
does it?
Well, according to them, it does. I don't know. But
so,
all
right. So I think just for the purposes of our hypothetical, we're just going to have to settle on one or the other. They're either conscious of the experiences. Like, are they going to remember the shit after they get cured?
Well, it's not necessarily whether they remember it, it's whether they experience it that matters.
So, I guess just summarize utilitarian. I mean, even with all these disagreements about what we mean by happiness, what we mean by whose happiness, summarize utilitarianism.
Okay. Sum total of awesome feelings. You want to make that the most. Want to make that higher.
Okay.
Everybody, take everybody, all their awesome feelings. You want to make them more.
We're talking about mean awesomeness?
Mean awesomeness,
median,
yes.
Median awesomeness?
Mean awesomeness, I think.
So, like, one person could be ecstatically happy.
Well.
Everyone else kind of.
I mean, it's very unlikely you would encounter that sort of experience.
But yes.
But yeah. So the idea is that, you know, across the total sum, you know, total of people in the entire world, you want their awesome feelings to be really high, not low.
Okay.
Anything that makes that higher is good.
All right. So, first example. Alex, restate our first example for us.
Okay, you see a zombie far off across a river or a canyon. You have a rifle and could easily kill the zombie with a single shot from this distance. The zombie would not pose a threat to you for the foreseeable future.
Okay, so just to be clear, the zombie, we know they're dangerous, but there's no
not
evidence.
To you, not
right.
To anyone for any normal amount of time.
It's like in the wilderness.
Yeah,
like
it's
middle
sort
nowhere.
Of, you know, out away from you and isolated from you.
All right. So I think under the categorical imperative, at least under the second formulation, when we're talking about the humanity formulation, all this, for me, comes back to whether or not zombies are capable of rational thought. Would you even agree with that premise?
Depends on what you mean by capable of rational thought.
I mean capable of rational thought.
As in, at the time you're talking to them?
Yeah,
you're talking about them?
Because remember, one of the reasons that Kant would say murder is wrong. It's not just because of the universal formulation where if everybody murdered people, there would be no people left, and therefore you can't conceive the world. I don't even mean that. The second formulation, respecting humanity, respecting rationality, he would say that you can't kill another person because you're not respecting their humanity. You're treating them as a means to your own ends. You're not treating them as an end in themselves. You're not treating them as unconditionally good. And so part of this comes down to whether or not a zombie is even a rational creature. Because again, he doesn't limit his discussion to rationality either. He doesn't limit it to human beings. He limits it to creatures capable of rational thought. And when he says rational thought, I mean, it means roughly something like creatures able to follow rules, able to obey rules and rational thought.
So my response would be that zombies, viral zombies, mind you, are in the same category as, for instance, a person who is in a coma or someone who is just drugged to the point that they're incapable of rational thought but could theoretically recover from that.
Okay.
So you can't treat them as lacking the capacity for rational thought because it might merely be a temporary condition. And we don't treat people who are temporarily impaired as if they are subhuman. And if we did, the world would be a radically different place.
Okay, so what's your Kantian analysis of that situation?
My Kantian analysis is, all right, so there are two sorts of Kantian analyses that I will focus on in this discussion. First is what Kant would actually say. Now, Kant, as I understand him, would say you can't kill anyone simply because...
Or you, Kant.
Oh, my God. You can't kill anyone because you'd be using their... You'd be extinguishing their humanity, their ability for rational thought, you would be destroying that. And you can't do that under any circumstances, where there's nothing more important than a person's ability to you know, their capacity for rational thought.
Wait a minute, there's a weird irony in all that, though. I mean, there's this argument that zombies have rational thought, but have rational thought, but they're acting irrationally because they're going out devouring people because of a virus, which is displacing their ability act rationally.
It's that they could someday act rationally again.
Okay.
If their their zombification is cured.
Well, not only that, I mean, he even recognizes that people don't act rationally anyway.
Well, yeah, that too. So that's that Kant's like what Kant would actually say, he would say no killing under any circumstances, so you can't kill the zombie. My formulation, my sort of interpretation of the categorical imperative goes according to the universal law formulation. So I use that as a guide and say, so my maxim is when my life is threatened by an unjust, culpable aggressor, I'll defend myself with lethal force if necessary to save my life. Now, the universal law that results from that maxim is whenever a person's life is threatened by an unjust, culpable aggressor, they'll defend themselves with lethal force if it's necessary to save their life.
You say defriend.
Defend.
I think you said defriend.
You said defriend. That's
whatever. Defend.
What? Like on Facebook, they say, like, nope, defriend with lethal force.
I will defriend
you. Guys,
you.
You have the shittiest posts.
No, sorry. That's unfriending, not defriending.
Wait.
Oh, it's defriending.
Anyway, defend. Sorry.
You said defriend, though.
Defriend means...
I was a little too drunk to enunciate properly.
Preventing friendship.
Give me a little slack here,
from,
man.
From the get-go.
Yeah, from the get-go. Okay. So we're not going to establish a friendship.
So we're
they will
gonna
defend
say, like,
themselves.
Your, right. Deny your request.
With
to
right,
to
that's
be friends.
That's defriending. Okay.
Okay. Whenever a person's life is threatened by an unjust, culpable aggressor,
okay,
they will defend themselves with lethal force. Force.
Wait, what is
shut up,
wait, lethal
shut
fourth?
Shut up.
Why not
force,
lethal third
force,
or lethal fifth?
Force.
I don't know why you're
shut up.
The fourth rather than third or the fifth. But go on.
Lethal force if it is necessary to save their life.
Okay.
Okay, so the third step of the universal law formulation is asking if, you know, in such a world, is the maxim even conceivable? Is there some logical contradiction in having such a world? And in my opinion, there is no contradiction there, since there could still be unjust, culpable aggressors in such a world, even though everyone tries their best to defend against them. And so there's nothing inconsistent about the maxim that you will defend with lethal force against an unjust, culpable aggressor.
Okay. I guess in my mind, though, it's still... What about the second formulation, that humanity formulation? It almost seems like... I guess in my mind, when you ask self-defense... When you ask the question about self-defense generally, it's almost as if... And even taking zombies out of the equation. So say that you're just defending yourself against another person. It almost seems as if self-defense is a morally neutral act under Kant's categorical imperative, the second formulation. And the reason I think it's morally neutral is because you have two possible outcomes. You have the outcome that you die because they're going to kill you, or they die because you're going to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. And if we're focusing on whether or not you're extinguishing a rational creature, whether you're ending a life, because again, lives are unconditionally good. It doesn't matter under Kant's categorical imperative, kind of what wrongs you have committed during your life, a human life or a rational life, a rationality is unconditionally valuable. It seems like it's a morally neutral act because it's either one rationality will be extinguished versus another.
Okay, so it's not impermissible to defend yourself.
is what you're saying.
So in the first example, with the zombies far off, your life
that's
is not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say not, I would actually say your life's not in immediate danger. So
agreed.
Yeah, I would say under a Kantian analysis, you probably should. You probably can't.
That fits my maxim of using lethal force only if it is necessary to save your life.
So what about a utilitarian analysis in this case?
Okay, so a utilitarian analysis would depend
on...
We've
got 10 of these. We'll move through them.
Yeah, the other ones are going to be pretty similar. So a utilitarian analysis probably would reach the same result as long as... It would depend to some extent on what the expected risk is to other people and to yourself in the long run, but probably, you know, if they're isolated from the rest of humanity, killing them wouldn't really increase happiness any, aside from your thrill in getting the shot. You know, that's not much compared to the possibility that you could someday cure them and they could experience, you know, all these higher pleasures and be, you know, happy, productive members of society. I think that utilitarianism would say, no, you can't kill them there.
So does killing the zombie in the first example lead to more happiness?
I think in an average case, probably not. But, I mean,
does
it's probably
lead to
not
less there. Happiness?
Yeah, probably less happiness. Because there's a chance
Why?
That the zombie could be cured, and then you'd have a real, you know, human person having all this sort of happy experiences, being saved, getting to live a happy life, you know, having little babies of their own, and, you know, grow up all big and strong, and, you know, that's
living,
a lot of
living in suburbia with a white picket fence.
If that's their thing. I mean, you know, and being able to enjoy all this sorts of experiences of life that they wouldn't be able to do if you shot them. Whereas
it almost seems like utilitarianism is so incredibly speculative.
Well, no, it's just a matter of evaluating the most likely expected results. I mean,
it almost seems speculative.
Well, it's not like it's just some random pull it out of a hat crap. You have to have good reason for what you're doing.
What I'd like to do, real quick, I'd like you to answer, one, whether it's okay to kill a zombie under example one, scenario one, under Kantianism, and a one-sentence explanation of why. Two, whether it's okay to do so under utilitarianism, and a one-sentence explanation of why.
They're not aggressors, therefore they're not a blameworthy aggressor, therefore no, under Kantianism. Two, no, that would not increase happiness. There's too much potential for happiness in a cured zombie, and too little potential for decreased unhappiness in saving someone who's probably not in danger anyway.
Right. I would say under Kantianism, on the first example, no, it's not okay to kill them, because even though self-defense may be a morally neutral act, I don't think you're really defending yourself in the first example, because there's just far too much ambiguity as to why the zombie is going do. For a utilitarianism approach, I would say probably no, you shouldn't kill them again just because ambiguity. I don't think you're really you're not really increasing happiness. I mean, if anything, you're really only decreasing it because it doesn't seem like they may never even come into contact with anyone else. And so their happiness is really the only happiness that matters, and you would be extinguishing
that. Ambiguity rules against violence.
I would say so. Josh. Looking, contemplating. We'll get Chinese after this, after you make your decision on example one.
I think both Kantianism and utilitarianism are going to come to the same outcome, which is you have a moral obligation to refrain from killing a zombie that's on the other side of a canyon or river or some other isolated area, simply because you don't accomplish anything in the short term or the long term. You're not
protecting anybody, you're not protecting yourself. And there is the potential of a happier life, as Alex said, if a cure is developed and they're able to get on with a normal human life. So yeah, in the first scenario, it seems fairly clear.
Okay. Chinese food break.
Now that we have the hiccups because of alcohol and spicy food, we should definitely move on to example two.
Fuck that.
No, we need to. Alex, what is example two?
Example two. You are in a fortified building and see a zombie approach. It does not pose any immediate threat, but it could become one if the defenses fall.
If the defenses fall. Okay. So, how likely is it that the defenses are going to fall?
Fuck if I know, man. Just, you know.
5%.
Maybe, yeah.
5%.
So unlikely, I mean, I guess if it's unlikely, it seems like our first example, right? Where the zombie's kind of off in the distance. It's not really posing a huge immediate threat to us. It sort of seems like
have more of a significant chance of failure.
So like a 50-50. So like we don't know.
Something like that.
So if we don't know if the defenses are going to fall, it seems like we might want to take the, I guess just, we might want, we might want to take the stance that we should protect ourselves preemptively. So we might want to prevent the zombies from coming to get us and killing them. The Kantian approach always seems to say, human life is, or rational life is unconditionally valuable. So it's like almost in any scenario, it's very hard to justify self-defense. As far as the utilitarian approach is concerned, it seems a little bit more difficult. So I think I can make a case that, for instance, I should, what was the example again?
To kill a zombie, what?
What was the example again? Example two.
You're in a fortified building and see a zombie approach. It's not an immediate threat, but it could become one if the defenses fall.
Okay. Utilitarianism approach. So,
I mean, for most of the examples from here on out, almost all of them, the Kantian approach is going to say no killing.
Okay.
Either Kantian approach, either Kant's Kant or my Kant.
And why is that?
Because there's no unjust, there's no culpable aggressor committing an unjust attack. Where were we before that?
So, sorry. Example two, and basically just saying, like, do you think, so what would Kant have to say for the rest of the examples? That it's not okay?
Fuck that, yeah, he'd say no.
Okay. But utilitarianism, so for the second example, you're in a fortified location.
Well,
right?
In that case, it would depend to some extent on your situation. So,
well, I want to challenge that, actually. What if, okay, I mean, does Kant only evaluate the moral outcomes based on the immediate consequences of the decision, or?
He doesn't take consequences into account at all.
Okay.
This is not about consequences, this is about rules. But utilitarianism takes the consequences into account, stretching out to infinity, essentially.
Okay.
Well, maybe.
Well, essentially.
Well, it's a question of whether actual consequences versus foreseeable consequences, right?
Well, okay. But foreseeable consequences can still stretch pretty far.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, yeah, you can't predict everything, but to the extent that you can predict something, it must be factored in.
So what's example three?
Example three, you see a zombie from across a large field moving slowly. It could become a threat if you don't move, but you have plenty of time to retreat and could escape without much difficulty.
So it's not like the first example where it's actually obstructed.
Right.
It can get to you, it's just far away.
It's just pretty far away, so you could, if you make a concerted effort, you could get away.
I guess I don't see a difference between that example and the first example.
Well, in the third example, there are some strategically valuable asset to this location that you would have to give up to escape.
Okay.
So
you know, it might be the high ground, or it might be, you know, a particular building that's got lots of resources in it that you might have to flee from to escape the zombie. So in that case, it might be permissible to kill the zombie in order to maximize your chances of survival and those of people around you.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, yeah, if it's just, you know, you just have to move, but otherwise your situation would be unchanged, then, yeah, you probably would not be justified.
Okay.
And, of course, under a Kantian analysis, you would not be justified, period, under this situation.
I think under the Kantian analysis, again, it kind of comes back to why I think in the first example, there's too much ambiguity to really justify you extinguishing the rationality of another creature. Mm-hmm. On the utilitarian perspective, I guess I also don't see enough difference in this one from the first two approaches either.
Okay, so, situation four. Zombie is right outside your door and will quickly become a threat, but you might be able to escape out the back door before it can reach you.
Oh,
50-50. 50-50.
Yeah.
What, so if you try to escape, you're going to die? Is that the assumption? Like, so if you try escaping, there is no back door, the back door is bolted shut, and you don't have...
Then you would die.
Then you would
or,
die.
Or you'd have to fight your way out.
Okay.
Sure, I'm confused.
So, there's a zombie right outside the door, right?
Okay.
That's the thing.
So you're saying you have two choices. You either...
Stay and fight.
Shoot that zombie the fuck up. Or run.
Precisely.
I would say, like, why not err on the side of caution?
And run?
And run. Shoot.
Okay, err on the side of caution can mean two different things.
I would say err on the side of caution and run if you can.
Okay.
But isn't an error?
But if it's
caution also shooting the zombie.
I would say in that case, yeah, like 50-50. Well, but 50, I mean, if it's a 50-50 chance,
I don't know. Erring on the side of the caution here, by shooting the zombie, you are never erring on the side of caution, by guaranteeing you don't have to risk.
Yeah, but
find out whether or not the door's open.
Yeah, but by not shooting the zombie, you're also erring on the side of caution of allowing that creature to live. That seems to be like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. So, example five.
Like,
a zombie is chasing...
I'm really drunk, but this Chinese food is really good.
Thank you, that's very relevant. So,
you're welcome.
A zombie is chasing you down
food.
It's good. A zombie
what did you
is...
get?
Spicy shrimp, okay?
Is it spicy?
It is spicy.
Yeah, but the hot sauce before you're tasting it.
So you don't know if the spicy shrimp is really spicy.
I had some before I added the hot sauce. It wasn't that hot, so I added the hot sauce, and then it was hot.
You're hot.
Okay, anyway. Okay, so a zombie is chasing you down the street, and would probably catch and kill you before you could run to safety unless you fight back and kill it. In that case, I think the utilitarian answer is that you could defend yourself.
So you have to fight the zombie.
Well, you could try and run away. And, you know, there's a possibility that you could escape without being caught. But it's not a 50-50 chance. It's more like a 20-80 chance.
Okay, so I guess what would be the problem under the Kantian analysis here?
Well, the Kantian analysis, you can't kill them. They're not culpable aggressors, so you can't kill them.
Right,
period.
But I think Kant's argument will tie back to the axe murderer case, where even if you tell the truth and allow the murderer to come in and murder your family, you're not morally culpable for the murderer's actions, right? So in this case, you're not morally culpable for the zombie killing you. Well, the only thing that matters is whether or not your choices are moral. But in this case... like killing the other person, you're taking...
Wait, so do you kill the other person or do you not under a Kantian analysis?
You don't. You still don't want to kill them.
Why?
Because allowing them to kill you is still the right thing under his... I don't know. Actually, that's a little confusing. Like, is he only concerned about what the individual's choice is in the scenario?
I don't know. It's
because,
it's confusing.
Because I thought... Okay. His conclusion was still that you should tell the truth, even though they're going to kill the
right.
Person
you can't lie to the axe murderer at the door.
But at the same time, he still says that every human life is valuable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
second formulation, right?
You should still have
an obligation to protect those people's lives.
Sure.
But for some reason, he still sides with the decision that you should still tell the truth.
Correct.
So how do you resolve that?
That's a great question, Joshua. I mean, one of the criticisms of Kant's theory is that it's too abstract to actually apply. Because, I mean, it's supposed to be a prescription for how you're going to act in the world, right? So if we have to go through these mental gymnastics and try to figure out, well, what the fuck would Kant say in this situation? It seems to completely defeat the purpose. I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
That whole murder.
It seems to go against his idea that all rational creatures are going to arrive at the same answers, because three of us seem to not be able to come to any kind of agreement on how to act.
Come to some agreement on the different, you know, ways. I mean,
oh, I don't remember because I've been drunk.
That's okay, Yossi. We still love you, but you know you should calm down a bit.
Okay.
Anyway, so. Are you okay, Yossi?
Yeah, I want to get an onion.
Okay.
Boom.
So the idea is that...
That's a good onion.
Yes, it is. So under Kant's
really good onion.
Analysis of Kant...
He says analysis. Analysis.
Under Kant's analysis, as told by Kant, none of these cases of self-defense would be permissible. Because you could never kill someone. But my problem is that that means that you would also be required to tell the truth to the murderer at the door and allow him to murder all these innocent people, which I think, and many other people think, is a straightforward reductio of his view.
Okay.
Of his entire system. So I think that's correct, that it is a reductio of his view, and it proves that he's wrong about the whole murder at the door scenario. He's also wrong about the whole, you know, there can be no exception to, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Kant would say you can't fight back. Utilitarianism would say you can definitely fight back because, you know, you're in extreme risk of death. You know, you'd probably die. And so you could fight back, according to utilitarianism. According to my analysis of Kant, you could not fight back because they're not culpable aggressors.
You can't fight back.
Oh, my God, Yossi. We can't even take you out of
public. All right, number six.
Several zombies are chasing you down the street, and one of them would probably catch and kill you unless you fight them. Now, here is where utilitarianism gets kind of weird. So Kant says, no, you can't fight them. My Kant also says you can't fight them because none of them are culpable aggressors. In this case, numbers are a factor. So on a utilitarian analysis, you have to think about not just whether you're likely to, you know, have more happiness than the zombie that you kill would, you know, assuming reasonable expectation of a cure or not. You also have to consider the fact that there are several zombies. And you'd have to kill several of them, and so all of a sudden the probabilities are much different. So if, for instance, you think that it's probable that, if you think that there's about a 20% probability of a cure being found in a reasonable time period, soon enough to cure all of these zombies that are attacking you, well then, all of a sudden, if there are six zombies, then that's 1.2 people's worth of, you know, lives worth of happiness that you're extinguishing by killing six zombies, whereas you're only saving one person's, yours. So in that case, I think even utilitarianism might say you shouldn't kill them.
Can we? I guess one question is, can we boil down utilitarianism? Can we boil it down to specific calculation?
In this situation, I think you could argue that if you know, a reasonable estimate of the chances of a cure being found in a reasonable time period are 20%, then you couldn't kill them. Whereas if it's more like 10%, then you probably could. So it's all going to depend on what the probabilities are and how you evaluate that. And
this just strikes me kind of like gambler's logic.
Well, no, because
it seems like subjective, like 20% versus 10%.
Well, here's the
thing. What's the difference?
Other than 10% being the difference, what's the difference? But what's the meaning?
That is the difference.
But what's the meaningful difference in terms of how you act?
Whether you kill the zombies or not, man, that's the whole thing.
Okay, so if there's a 20% chance that you'll live if you...
No, there's just a 20% chance that that a cure will be found in time to save them.
Then you shouldn't kill them, but if there's a 10% chance, then you should.
Precisely.
Why? Why 10%?
20% times 6 zombies means 1.2.
Right, but I'm just saying, why... Right?
That's more than one. That's more than the life you're going to save by saving yourself.
Oh, so you're saying if it's more than one life...
Total life saved.
Total life saved, then do it. If it's less than one total life saved, don't do it.
Reverse that, but yeah.
Okay. I'm drunk, so it makes drunk sense to me, I think.
It also makes relatively sober sense.
Okay. I believe you.
Okay, so
What's the next one?
Next scenario is, scenario 7 is, a zombie has you cornered in a room and will quickly kill you unless you fight back. So, on Kant's Kantian analysis, you can't fight back. On my Kantian analysis, you still can't fight back. But under utilitarian analysis, you pretty much definitely can fight back. Because it's just one life versus another.
Number 8!
Several zombies have you cornered in a room and will quickly kill you unless you fight back.
I'm gonna fucking kill those bitches. I don't give a fuck what utilitarianism or Kantianism says. I'm gonna kill those bitches.
Number 9.
Actually, that's a legitimate question, though. Do we really need these theories to tell us what to do in particular situations? If you're cornered by a bunch of zombies in a room, I'm gonna fucking kill those bitches.
You're drunk, Yossi.
I know, but...
You're just drunk.
I'm drunk. But if you are cornered by zombies in a room, though...
My point
is... What do you do?
Well,
so... Like, just spur of the moment, what do you do? Do you actually take the time to work through these theories?
Ideally, you have taken the time beforehand. I mean, if it's just like your first encounter with zombies is a bunch of them have cornered you and are attacking you, then you're probably just going to act on instinct. And, you know, it'd be hard to blame you for killing them. But... Assuming that you have some experience with the concept of zombies and know what's going on in the world, then you kind of have to think about it. And in that case, you might think that, you know, depending on the probability of people finding a cure for, you know, zombification, it might matter how many zombies you have to kill to save yourself. So if there is, say, a 10% chance of a cure for hepatitis Z, give or take, and there are 20 zombies that you would have to kill, and you know you would have to kill every last one of them to escape, well then you'd have to kill essentially 2 lives worth of expected value to save your 1 life of expected value. And that would not be permissible according to utilitarianism.
So if you're... Even if you're trapped in a room with zombies, like, viciously clawing at you.
I mean, you could try and run and push them out of the way without killing them.
You could use non-lethal force.
I feel like we're not using numbers in the right
way. In that case, killing the zombie would always result in a positive outcome because you're saving yourself a whole life plus whatever additional amount.
Minus all the probability that they live and are cured.
Oh, sorry, I got that backwards.
So I just want to say that I lost the ability to number, like, a while ago.
It's okay, Yossi. We'll figure it out. Don't worry. Number 9, we're wrong?
11.
No, I think we're on number 9.
We were just on 8. Okay, so number 9. This is where it gets me. Okay. A person who was a zombie groupie, i.e. they thought that being a zombie was a great thing and deliberately got themselves infected.
What a bitch.
You would do that. I would never do that.
No, you wouldn't. I'm sorry.
They are chasing you and will kill you unless you fight back. Now, under Kant's Kant, you can't kill them because, or at least it's morally neutral because they're a rational life, whatever, right?
At that point, they're probably not even rational. So.
Well, yeah.
Then you go from Bella from Twilight because she's a fucking retard.
Fuck Twilight.
Because she's a fucking
under Kant's Kant, you can't kill them because you can never.
It's irrelevant.
Kill them. Right.
It's irrelevant whether they intended to do this or not. They're unconditionally valuable, blah, blah, blah.
Under my Kant, though, you can kill them in this instance because they are a culpable aggressor. They are at fault for the fact that they're attacking you and trying to kill you. 10th example. Same as the 9th example.
Okay.
Zombie groupie, except this zombie groupie has information that would be vital to saving millions of lives.
Waterboard them.
Oh, God, Yossi. So, if you kill them, you're basically killing millions and millions of people along with them by destroying the information that they have.
Okay.
But there is a cure in the works that will be available in the near future. Near enough that we'll be able to cure them and then get the information that they have.
Of, like, who they've bitten, blah, blah, blah.
Of information about where resources can be found that could turn the tide against the zombies and save the world.
Okay.
Right? Billions of lives are at stake here. So if they attack you, suddenly, according to utilitarianism, you can't kill them. Because they're too valuable. They're so valuable to the world that killing them would not be justified by saving, you know, by saving yourself.
Okay. Because
there's just billions of lives at stake. Whereas under Kant's, under my Kantian analysis, you could still kill them because they are a culpable aggressor.
But then, and then I would say something like, oh, but all the other rational beings, blah, 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 that is my
spiel.
Kantian response is to say something about something about stuff. I'm gonna drink more.
That was very coherent, Yossi. I wanna congratulate you.
I'm gonna get tissue, I'm gonna use a napkin. So wait, what's the... Do we have a conclusion?
I have an example from the movie that might be relevant. So if you've ever seen the movie Zombieland, you know that the zombie kill of the week went to Sister Cynthia Knickerbocker, who killed a zombie by luring it to the doorway of a church and then dropping a piano onto it after she walked into the door and closed it behind her. Now, that's essentially situation two. She was in a fortified building, a building that could be fortified easily. Saw a zombie approach.
Fortified by God.
Also by wood. But yeah. It didn't pose any immediate threat. It could have posed a threat if the defenses fell, but no, it wasn't really a threat right then. And she killed it immediately. Bam! Just, you know, flatten that thing. Kant would say that that was not justified. I would say, under a Kantian analysis, that was definitely not justified. And even under a utilitarian analysis, probably wasn't justified either. And yet, nobody ever thinks that it's not okay to kill zombies. You know, we all just watch these movies and think, okay, yeah! You know, just root for them.
So essentially the conclusion is, Kant, there's no situation allowed where you can kill the zombie.
Yes.
With utilitarianism, you just have to calculate the probability
as best
there
you
being
can.
A cure versus, and weigh that against saving your own life.
Yeah.
Okay. So
whereas
one of those scenarios,
my Kantian analysis is about culpability, and you have to decide, you know, you have to figure out whether the aggressor is culpable. And if they are, then you can defend yourself against them. If they're not, then, you know, you have to find another way out without hurting them, without killing them.
All right. Well, I think we've exhausted. God's even made me so sad. I think we've exhausted all of morality at this point.
If you say so.
So on the next World of Power Hour, we're going to be talking about unicorns.
Woo, unicorns!
We're going to, move from zombies to unicorns. So really the hard-hitting issues that really affect everyday aspects of life and stuff, because the stuff.